Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kishore Hari, Program Chair for the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your co-chair for today's program. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker tonight, Professor Michael Eisen. Professor Michael Eisen is an investigator in the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, an associate professor of genetics, genomics, and development at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Eisen completed his PhD at Harvard College under the supervision of Dr. Don Wiley while studying influenza A virus proteins. Professor Eisen's academic research now focuses on the evolution of gene regulation in flies. Throughout his career, he has been a forceful advocate for open science, the free release of the material and intellectual product of scientific research. He is a leading advocate of open access scientific publishing and is a co-founder and board member of the Public Library of Science, a San Francisco nonprofit dedicated to making the world's scientific and medical literature a freely available public resource. Please join me in welcoming Professor Michael Eisen.
Thanks a lot. Thanks to Chisako and Kishore for inviting me, the Commonwealth Club for having me, and for all of you for listening. I'm going to try doing something I don't usually do, which is reading a talk. I have a prepared remarks. I'm usually far more extemporaneous, or some people might say random. So forgive me if it seems a little stiff at times, but I'm going to try to stick to what I've written, if my screen cooperates. So on January 6th of 2001, 24-year-old hacker and activist Aaron Schwartz was arrested by police at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for downloading several million articles from an online archive of research journals called JSTOR. After Schwartz committed suicide earlier this year in face of legal troubles that arose from this incident, questions were raised about why MIT, whose access to JSTOR he exploited, chose to pursue charges against him, and what motivated the U.S. Department of Justice to demand jail time for his transgressions. But the question that should have been asked is why downloading scholarly research articles was a crime in the first place. Why is it that 20 years after the birth of the modern internet, it's a felony to download works that academics chose to share with the world? The internet, after all, was invented so that scientists could communicate their research results with each other. But while you can now get free access to 675 million, I checked this morning, 675 million videos of cats, the scholarly literature, which is one of the greatest public works projects of all time, remains locked behind expensive paywalls. So every year, universities, governments, and other organizations spend on the order of $10 billion to buy back access to papers that researchers gave to journals for free, while teachers, students, healthcare providers, and members of the public, like many of you, are left completely out in the cold. Even worse, the stranglehold that journals have on academic publishing has stifled efforts to improve the way that scholars communicate with each other and the public. In an era when anyone can share anything with the entire world at the click of a button, the fact that it takes a typical scientific paper 9 months to be published should be a scandal. So these delays, they matter to everybody. They slow down the progress in science, and in many cases, they literally cost people their lives. So tonight, I'm going to describe how we got to this place, this ridiculous place, how 20 years of avarice from publishers, conservatism from researchers, fecklessness from universities and funders, and a basic lack of common sense from everyone has made the research community and the public miss the opportunities created by the internet to transform how scholars communicate their ideas and discoveries. I'm also going to talk about what some of us, many of you in this room, have been doing to liberate the scholarly literature, where we've succeeded and where there's more work to be done. And finally, with these efforts to do that gaining traction, I'm going to describe where we, at least I think we should be going next. So while I talk, I want you to keep a couple things in mind. And one of them is that this is more than just about academic publications. This is about the future of the internet. It's about what we're willing to do as individuals and societies to ensure that information that should be free is free. And if we can't figure out how to make scientific and scholarly works, most of which were funded by taxpayers and published by authors who have no expectation of being paid, if we can't make these freely available, we're going to struggle to do this with in cases where the conditions for free access are less right. And just one little bit of introduction, you already heard this. So I'm a scientist, and so for the rest of this talk, I'm going to focus on the scientific literature. But everything I will say holds equally true for other areas of scholarship, for the humanities and so forth. Okay, so a little bit of history. So most people date the birth of the modern scientific journal to the middle of the 17th century, most people who bother to do this, when the Royal Society in England took advantage of the growing printing industry to begin publishing proceedings of their meetings for the benefit of members unable to attend, as well as for posterity. But the scientific journals, as we know them today, were really a product of the 19th century, when growing activity and public interest in science led to the creation of most of the big titles that we know about today. Science, Nature, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and The Lancet, published their first editions at some point in the 1800s. At the beginning, these journals had noble missions. For example, if you go back to the first issue of Science magazine, in its preface, published in July 1880, it stated that its goal was to afford scientific workers in the United States the opportunity of promptly recording the fruits of their researches, and importantly, facilities for communication between one another and the world. So note that. It was about publishing for the world. Like their predecessors, these journals were enabled by the technologies of the Industrial Revolution, in this case. Steam-powered rotary printing presses that could produce lots of pages, and efficient rail-based mail service that would allow them to disseminate their works. But they were also severely limited by these technologies. Printing and shipping articles around the country and the world was and remains expensive. And because of this, two key features of modern journals were established back then. First, these journals limited what they printed, choosing for publication only those works deemed to be of the greatest interest to their target audience. And second, they sold subscriptions, sending copies only to those who had paid. While intrinsically restricting, not everybody could get copies of these journals, the business arrangement made sense. Every printed copy of a journal incurred a cost to the publisher, and charging readers meant revenue scaled with costs. And as science grew, so too did science publishing, with increasingly specific journals emerging to cater to new disciplines. And by 1990, where really this story starts, there were around 5,000 scientific journals in circulation, all of them printed and shipped to subscribers. And the cost of these journals were skyrocketing already. If you were lucky enough to be at a major research university like I was, you could find most of these journals in the library. But most scientists had to make do with a small subset of this literature, whatever their libraries could afford. And the public was all but completely shut out of access to the literature. And then along came the internet. Right? So scientific journals, who were serving a computer-savvy audience with fast access to the internet connections through their universities, were amongst the first big commercial ventures to take advantage of this new technology. Within a period of a very few years, from really 1995 to 1998, virtually all major publishers put versions of their printed journals online. But in doing so, they made a crucial and, in my opinion, fateful choice. Rather than adapting their business models to the new medium, they stuck with the same subscription-based system that had been used by print journals for the last 300 years. And, you know, from their point of view, why not? So long as scientists were willing to keep giving them papers and universities were willing to buy them back, it was a great business, a very profitable business. And it was an even better one, given that they no longer had to pay for printing and shipping. Their costs dropped, but their business model didn't. But with this major shift in the means of dissemination, what was once a common sense way for publishers to provide a valuable service while dealing with the limits of available technology, it became an irrational impediment to achieving this very goal. And so to understand just how crazy this system is, you have to understand a little bit more about how scientific journals and scientific publishing works and what the life cycle of a scientific idea looks like. I realize many of you know this, so bear with me as I go through it. So if you take your typical scientist at my home institution, UC Berkeley across the bay, she draws her salary from the state of California and works in a building funded by the state. When she has a new idea, she goes out and raises money to buy equipment and supplies and to pay the salaries of the students and staff who will actually do the work in her lab. In all likelihood, this money is going to come from the U.S. government through funding agencies like the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation. And if it doesn't come from them, it comes from a public-minded nonprofit or foundation like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, who funds research in my lab. So this scientist and her students then spend a great deal of time, usually we're talking about years, pursuing the idea until they finally have a result that they want to share with their peers. So they sit down, they write a paper, this itself is a time-consuming endeavor, describing why they were interested in the question in the first place, what they did to explore it, how they did it, what they found, and what they think it means. And then they hopefully submit it to, and I mean full of hope here, not submit it to one of the 10,000 journals currently in operation today, choosing an appropriate journal based on its scope and importance. With few exceptions, these journals work in the same way. The paper, when it comes to the journal, is assigned to an editor, sometimes a salaried professional, but usually a practicing scientist volunteering their time. They read the paper and decide who, amongst all the possible people in the field, is in the best position to evaluate the author's methods, data, and conclusions, and they send the paper to these scientists, who again, volunteering their time as a service to the community, read it and render their opinion on the paper's technical merits and suitability to the journal in question. The editor then gathers these reviews, looks at them, and decides whether or not to accept the paper for publication, to ask the authors to modify it, or to reject it so they send it to another journal. If the paper is accepted, the journal takes the manuscript, converts it into a publishable form, and posts it on the web. If the paper is not accepted, the scientists either go back and do some more work and rewrite the paper, or they send it to some other journal, triggering a complete reprise of the entire process. So I want you to note that in comparison to what's done by the scientists here, just how little the journal is actually doing. They didn't come up with the idea, they didn't provide the grant, they didn't do the research, they didn't write the paper, they didn't review it. What they did was to provide an infrastructure of peer review, people to chase reviewers and editors around to make sure that they're doing their job, and they take the paper and they prepare it for publication, which is not a trivial job. It's a tangible act, and it's a contribution, but it's a contribution that pales in comparison to the labors of the scientists involved and the support from the sponsors and funders of the research. And yet, for this modest, at best, role in producing the finished work, most publishers are rewarded with ownership in the form of copyright and complete control of the finished published work, which they then use and turn around and basically sell or lease back, depending on how you look at it, to the same institutions and agencies that sponsored the research in the first place. So thus, not only has the scientific community provided all the meaningful intellectual effort and labor to the endeavor, they're also fully funding the process. Right? So universities are, in essence, giving an incredibly valuable product. It's the end result of an investment of more than $100 billion of public funds every year across the world to publishers for free, and then they're paying them an additional $10 billion a year to lock these papers away where almost nobody can access them, right? Well, it would be funny, of course, if it weren't completely and tragically insane, right? So to appreciate just how bizarre this arrangement is, we like to use the following metaphor. So imagine you're an obstetrician, right? And now you're setting up a new practice. Your colleagues, they all make their money by charging parents a fee, a pretty good fee. They can go on nice vacations and buy nice cars for every baby they deliver. It's a very good living. But you have a better idea. In exchange for your services, you're going to demand that parents not give you a payment, they actually give you the baby, right? And in return for which, you agree to lease that baby back to the parents, provided that they're willing and able to afford your annual subscription fee, which you can set whatever you want, because you have their baby. Of course, no sane parent would agree to these terms, right? But the scientific community has agreed to exactly those terms in the way that we interact with scientific journals. And the consequences of this nutty decision are severe. So even though the entire scientific and medical literature is in principle now available at the click of a mouse to anyone with an internet connection, very few people actually have access to the entirety of this information. This is most obviously, and it's been discussed widely, a problem for people facing important medical decisions who have no access to the most up-to-date research on their conditions, research their tax dollars paid for. In a world where patients, I think probably all you know this, are increasingly involved in healthcare decisions, and where all sorts of sketchy medical information is available online, it's criminal that patients don't have access to high-quality research on whatever ails them and potential ways to treat it. Astonishingly, many physicians and healthcare providers also lack access to basic medical research. I actually occasionally give my doctor papers. Journal subscriptions in medicine are very expensive, and most doctors have access to only a handful of journals in their specialty, not to broad access to the medical literature. But this lack of access isn't a problem just in the doctor's office. Scores of talented scientists across the world, especially in developing countries, but also here in the U.S., are blind to the latest advances that could affect their research. And in the country, and in this country, students and teachers at high schools and small colleges are denied access to the latest work in fields they are studying, driving them to learn from textbooks or Wikipedia rather than the primary research literature. Technology startups, a lot of those around here, often can't afford access to the basic research they are trying to translate into useful products. And, you know, perhaps most relevant to you, interested members of the public find it difficult to engage directly with scientific research because they can't access the scientific literature. Is it really any wonder that such a large fraction of the population rejects basic scientific findings when the scientific community spends its time thumbing their collective noses at them by making it impossible for them to read about what we're doing with all the money that they've given us for our research? Right? Many in the publishing industry dismiss the idea that the public even wants to read scientific papers, pointing to their often highly technical language. But a major reason these papers are so inscrutable is that their authors conceive of their audience very narrowly, right? And basically thinking about their audience as other scholars in their field. So if you go into writing a paper with no expectation that the public will read your work, you don't write it in a way that it's accessible to the public. Okay. So I assume this doesn't apply to you in the audience, but even if you actually have no interest in reading the scientific literature at all, you should still care deeply about this issue. Because in addition to paywalls, the fact that the scientific literature is balkanized into hundreds of publisher fiefdoms, each of which with its own little subset of the scientific literature, this stops scientists from developing new ways to organize, extract information from, and improve the navigability of and utility of the scientific literature. It's astonishing, for example, that to this day, there's no single dedicated search engine that allows you to search the full text of every published scientific paper. You can't do it. Google sort of does it, but it doesn't do it well. This makes researchers far less effective, and it limits the value we all get from the billions of dollars we invest in science every year. And the greatest tragedy of all this is that it is totally and completely unnecessary. So back in the 1990s, when online publishing started, several people began promoting a simple alternative business model. The idea was to treat science publishing like a service, just like an obstetrician, with publishers getting paid a fee for the value they provide, but once that fee is paid, the finished product would effectively enter the public domain rather than the publisher's private one. So one of the people pushing this model, now known as open access, was my postdoctoral advisor, Pat Brown, sitting right over there. So he enlisted me in this crusade. Maybe he'll apologize for that, but anyway. After failing to convince existing publishers to adopt this model, which seemed so sensible at the beginning, they didn't treat it as a good idea. They treated it with outright laughter or hostility. The two of us, along with former NIH director Harold Varmus, launched a nonprofit publisher, which we dubbed the Public Library of Science, or PLOS, as you heard about before. And our goal was to prove that this model for scientific publishing would actually work. And after all, universities were already forking over billions of dollars to support publishers. We were offering them a better deal, access for everyone in the world at a lower price. But while logic and value were on our side, and we got statements of support from lots of people inside and outside the scientific community, when push came to shove, only a small group of pioneering scientists joined us in PLOS and in publishing in these journals. And the reason was that publishers had and continue to have one very powerful card up their sleeve. So although scientists don't get paid when the papers that we submit to research journals get published, they nonetheless receive something of very high value. So academia is an industry of prestige, and the currency in which prestige is traded is journal titles. In most scientists' mind, a publication in an elite journal like Nature or Science is as good as gold, a ticket to a job, grants, and tenure. And the allure of these publications is so high that most scientists continue to choose journals based entirely on their prestige, even while they acknowledge that their business practices are bad for science in the world. So realizing that our biggest obstacle was overcoming the prestige of established subscription-based journals, when PLOS launched, what we did was to create two journals that adopted the same elitist editorial policies of Science and Nature and their ilk. So PLOS Biology, which was our first journal in the basic science, and then shortly thereafter PLOS Medicine in the clinical world. We did everything these other journals did. We hired professional editors. We actually hired them away from other publishers. We built fancy editorial boards, had a suite of Nobel Prize winners singing our praises. This, we thought, would build up our prestige to a similar level. But prestige is a very difficult thing to engineer. Colleagues, friends, and even some unnamed family members would stipulate all the flaws in the current system and praise what we were doing. But when they had a high-profile paper, they would turn around and send it to the same old subscription journals. It was, for me, an incredibly frustrating experience after talking to tons and tons of people, hearing them say the right things, and then doing the wrong one. Honestly, I'd like to say I understood why they made these decisions, but I didn't. I thought and still think they were just being cowardly. And when I suggested that they were being chickens, or didn't just suggest, I told them they were being chickens, by sending their papers to Science and Nature, they would complain that they couldn't because their jobs or their trainees' jobs or their mom's job were at stake. And, you know, I didn't think they were right. I thought that they were exaggerating the power of these journals. But the truth is I didn't have a lot of evidence to show them. And this was happening at the same time we were starting PLOS. I was starting my own lab at Berkeley, right? And I was having senior colleagues come up to me, you know, knowing about my extracurricular activities involved with PLOS. They would take me aside and warn me that I would never get grants or tenure if I didn't publish my work in the old guard high-profile journals, and that I would ruin the careers of my trainees if I put my principles over these practical realities. And I'll say that I was told this by people who got jobs and tenure at Berkeley without publishing papers in high-profile journals. So there's a bit of an insanity. People think that this system is really powerful, much more powerful than it really is. But the idea that you have to publish in high-profile journals is pervasive. I'll say, you know, I didn't want to believe them. I really didn't think they were right. I thought they were mine. You know, I wanted to believe, and I still believe, that if I did good work, people would notice. But, you know, I wanted to work in a field where science didn't require, success in science didn't require capitulating to stupid, destructive traditions. I also knew, honestly, that I'd look like a complete hypocrite if I failed to live up to my own expectations. So I made a commitment for my lab that every paper would go to journals that made them freely available from day one. And, you know, 13 years later, I've stuck completely to my pledge. And you know what? The sky did not fall on me. I got grants. Then I got a tenure-track job at Berkeley. I actually didn't start at Cal. I started up the hill at the National Lab. Then I got tenure. Then I was named an investigator in the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. This is something lots of people coveted. It now funds my entire, you know, more or less my entire research lab. And the people in my lab haven't suffered either. My graduate students received fellowships. They've gone on to land good postdoctoral positions, except for one who went off to Facebook and is now a millionaire. Sure, he's not complaining. And my postdoctoral fellows have all gotten faculty positions at good schools. So, but despite this, despite the fact that we now had, at least in one case, empirical evidence showing that you didn't need to do all this to succeed in your careers, most of my colleagues still stand by the I need to publish in journal, blah, 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 in order to get whatever goal they're seeking at the time. So fortunately, publishing decisions are not entirely in the hands of individual investigators. In 2008, under pressure from Congress to provide taxpayers access to work they fund, the National Institutes of Health, who funds about $30 billion of research every year, implemented a public access policy that requires that its grantees make their work available through the National Library of Medicine online. So for their grantees, in principle, you should be able to get access to these papers. This was an important landmark in the history of the access movement, as really for the first time, a major funding agency was making it a condition of receiving a grant that authors make their work available to the public. And the policy has been reasonably successful. When last I checked, in a year ago or so, 80% of NIH funded works published in the previous year were now freely available online. And, you know, there's nothing like the threat of losing your funding to get people to do the right thing. Unfortunately, under pretty heavy lobbying pressure from publishers, the NIH policy does something stupid. It allows for up to a year's delay between publication and the provision of free access. While this is better than nothing, delayed access to the literature, you know, no longer provides the public with access to the latest advances in biomedical research than handing out copies of a year-old edition of the New York Times would keep you up to date on world events. This is an unacceptable capitulation to the publishers. So, you know, that was 5 years ago. Then earlier this year, under, again, similar pressure from Congress, the Obama administration weighed in on the matter, directing other federal agencies that fund large amounts of research, NSF, USDA, and others, to develop their own public access policies. In their statement on this matter, the White House said all the right things about the importance of public access and how great it would be if we all had access to the scientific literature, and they got a lot of positive press for their statement. But unfortunately, if somewhat predictably, their actions did not match their words. The new White House policy all but establishes this one-year delay used by the NIH as the law of the land. And even worse, it explicitly cited the need to sustain subscription-based publishing businesses as their excuse. It's really another missed opportunity in an area that has a ton of them. But at least the White House did something. Right, the other major player in this arena, the universities who employ the vast majority of academic scientists and whose policies on hiring and tenure shape the course of our careers, they have been completely silent on this matter. Right? As with funding agencies, universities have the power to hasten this transition to full access immediately. They can just say, look, you want a job at the University of California, you have to make your work freely available from the moment you're hired. Few people, I don't think any people, would turn down a job at a major research university if it came with this kind of requirement. But even as their own libraries sound the alarm about raising subscriptions costs and having to cancel subscriptions and diminishing access for people, university administrators across the country have done next to nothing. Actually, they've done nothing to promote changes in scientific publishing that would not only save them money, right? That's what they're all caring about, but it would make the research done on their campuses more efficient and effective and more high profile. It really is an astonishing abdication of their public mission and their responsibility as stewards of scholarship. So, however, despite these failings from scientists, from funders and universities, the facts on the ground actually are changing rapidly and in the right direction. So in 2007, PLOS launched a new journal, which we called PLOS One, that not only provided open access to all of its content, but it dispensed with the notion that's been central to journal publishing since the 17th century, that journals should select only papers of the highest interest to their readers. Rejecting papers that are technically sound is a relic of the age of printed journals, whose costs, again, scaled with the number of papers they published, and whose tables of contents served as a kind of guide for people to navigate the literature. But we're no longer limited as publishers by the number of articles we can publish. And people find papers not by looking at table of contents, but by searching. So PLOS One does something different. It simply asks its reviewers to assess whether the paper is a legitimate work of science. If it is, it's published. It's as simple as that. The whole process is simple. No need to ping pong from one journal to another in order to find the highest impact home for your work. Okay? And the idea evidently appeals to the scientific community, at least to some degree, because PLOS One has grown really rapidly. It will publish, I think this year, in excess of 25,000 articles. And though it's only 5 years old, it's now the biggest biomedical research journal in the world. And it publishes great science, right? PLOS One articles are routinely talked about by both science journalists and the popular press. You see mentions of PLOS One all the time, all over the place. And it's not just been a success as a journal, but it's been a success as a business. It turns a profit that's not only put PLOS on solid financial footing, but it's attracted the eye of commercial and nonprofit publishers worldwide. In the past several years, PLOS One clones have been popping up everywhere. There's a new one I hear about every couple of days. And I think there's fairly broad consensus that this sector, this big published, big journal sector, is going to grow and ultimately dominate scientific publishing. Okay. But the battle is really by no means won. Open access collectively, despite the success of PLOS One and other publishers, still only represents around 10% of the biomedical publishing. It has less of an uptake in other areas of science, and it's almost completely non-existent in the humanities. And still, most scientists still send their best papers to high-impact, subscription-based journals. But, as frustratingly slow as this progress has been, I really can't believe we're talking about this 15 years after we started. I believe we're close to a tipping point here where, most members of the scientific community believe, even if they're not acting on it yet, that open access is the future of publishing. And a growing and diverse set of publishers are engaged in open access businesses of some kind. But being able to access papers is and should be only the beginning. So now we can finally start to actually take advantage of computers and the internet to not just make the scientific publishing actually open, but to make it better. This is one of the things we started this whole process with our in mind. So if the founders of the Royal Society journals, were able to time travel from the 17th century and come back today and read a contemporary scientific journal, it is a damning statement that I think that they would find these journals very recognizable, right? They would look at them and find them disturbingly similar, right? So I can read a paper on my portable computer flying 35,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean, but the only thing that distinguishes a contemporary paper from a 17th century paper is maybe a slightly different font and the occasional color photograph, right? So the multi-layered hyperlink structure of the web was made for scientific communication, right? And yet papers today are largely dispersed and read as static PDFs. times. This is another relic of the days of printed papers. So PLOS and others are you know, working with the community to try to enable what we would call the paper of the future, right? That embeds not only things like movies, but access to the raw data and the tools we use to analyze them. It's insane that we haven't done this 20 years into the modern internet. There's also no need for papers to be static works that are fixed in a single form at the time of publication, right? Good data and good ideas in science are constantly evolving. And scientific papers should evolve over time as new data, analyses, and ideas emerge, whether they support or refute the original assertions. But the biggest target of our efforts remains, I think, the worst thing in science, and that's peer review. So peer review is the closest thing that science has to a religious doctrine. Right. Scientists believe that peer review is essential to maintain the integrity of the scientific literature, that it's the only way to filter through millions of papers to identify those that one should read, and that we need peer-reviewed journals to evaluate the contribution of individual scientists for hiring, funding, and promotion. I know from personal experience that attempts to upend or reform or even tinker with peer review are regarded by most people in the scientific community as apostasies. But the truth is that peer review, as we practice it today in the 21st century, poisons science. It's conservative, it's cumbersome, it's capricious, and it's incredibly intrusive. Right? It encourages groupthink, it slows down the communication of new ideas and discoveries, and it's ceded undue power to a handful of journals who stand as gatekeepers to success in the field. Each round of peer review, if you're lucky, takes a month, usually more. And it's rare for papers to be accepted without demanding additional experiments, analyses, or rewrites, which often take months and sometimes years for the authors to accomplish. And this time matters, right? Science is all about building on the results of others. But you can't build on the results of others if the results of others are languishing in peer review. Right? There really can be little doubt that the delays that we get, typical papers take 9 months, they often take years to be published, that this slows down scientific progress and that it kills people. Right? This might be worth it if the delays made the ultimate product better, but it's just not the case. While I'm sure that some egregious papers are prevented from being published by peer review, the reality is with 10,000 or so journals and the internet out there, most papers actually ultimately get published. And the peer-reviewed literature is filled with all manner of crappy papers. So even the supposedly more rigorous standards of the elite journals fail to prevent flawed papers from appearing in their pages. I'll refer to arsenic DNA and other things that have happened in the last couple of years. So while it's a nice idea to imagine peer review as defender of scientific integrity, it simply isn't. Flaws in a paper are far more often uncovered after the paper is published than during peer review. And yet, because we have a system that places so much emphasis on where a paper is published, we have no effective way to annotate previously published papers that turn out to be wrong. A Nature paper is always a Nature paper, even if it's been discredited. And as far as classification goes, does anybody actually think that assigning a paper to one of 10,000 journals organized in a loose and chaotic hierarchy of topics and titles is really the best way to help people browse the literature? I don't think anybody does, right? It's a relic of a bygone era, an artifact of the historical accident that Gutenberg invented the printing press before Al Gore invented the internet, right? So what would be better, right? The outlines of an ideal system are actually incredibly simple to spell out. There should be no journal hierarchy. There should be only journals like PLOS ONE. I'm not saying only PLOS ONE, although you wouldn't be upset, but journals like PLOS ONE, big journals that when the papers are submitted to these journals, they're, first of all, immediately made freely available for everybody, right? This idea that we're going to not publish papers while they sit and be reviewed and not make them available to other people in the community is insane, right? We can mark them. We can say that these papers are available and have not been reviewed, but they're there to be used by people in the field capable of deciding on their own if the work is sound and important, as the most relevant people for a given paper are. The journal would then organize a different type of peer review than we do today, in which experts in the field are asked if the paper is technically sound, as we currently do at PLOS ONE. But they're also asked what kind of scientists would find this paper interesting and how important it should be to them. This assessment would then be attached to the paper, there for everyone to see and use as they see fit, whether it be, you know, whether they want to use it to find papers, assess the contribution of authors, or decide if a work is sound or invalid. This simple process would capture all of the value in the current peer review system while shedding almost all of its flaws, right? It would get papers out fast to people most able to build on them, but would provide everyone else with a way to know which papers are relevant to them and a guide to their quality and import. by replacing the current journal hierarchy with a structured classification of research areas and levels of interest, this new system would undermine the really poisonous winner-take-all attitude associated with publications like Science or Nature. And by devaluing the assessment made at the time of publication, this new system ideally would facilitate the development of a robust system of post-publication assessment of works, in which individuals or groups, anybody who's reading a paper, is in a position to submit their own assessments of the paper at any point after they are published. Papers could then be updated to respond to the comments or to new information, and we would finally make the published scientific literature as dynamic as science itself. And it would all be there for anyone, anywhere, to not just access, to participate in. So there's nothing technically challenging about building such a system. Maybe the people at PLOS will laugh at me, but this is a relatively simple thing to do from a technical standpoint. And it makes so much sense that it can't help but happen, right? But of course, we've been there before, right? Science is oddly conservative, and there is enough money and power at stake to ensure that people will try to stop this from happening. You know it will happen. So if you care, people in the audience care about making the scientific literature open and accessible and useful, I urge you to do whatever you can do to make this happen. If you're a scientist, as I know many of you are, get with the program, okay? There's so many open access options out there today, you no longer have any excuse not to publish in them. And try to stop looking at journal titles when you evaluate people in their work. It's a poisonous process that has to stop. If you're not a scientist, many of you are not scientists, but you're interested in this cause, you can do all the normal things people ask you to do. Write your members of Congress, blah, 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 right? These are important things to do. Lobby anybody who matters to try to make this happen. But I also encourage you to do something else. Find scientists whose work you find interesting but cannot access and send them an email. Or better yet, call them or go to their offices. Let them know that you want to but cannot read their work. And remind them that in all likelihood, you paid for this. If we all do this, maybe next time someone like Aaron Schwartz comes along and tries to access every scientific paper ever written, instead of finding the FBI standing between them and this option, they'll find a giant green button that says download now. So anyway, thank you. I'll be happy to take any of your questions, and thanks for your attention.
Our thanks to Professor Eisen for his comments here today. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Reinventing Scientific Communication with Professor Michael Eisen. We're now going to open the floor to Q&A, and please keep your questions short and to the point and freely available to the public. If you can line up behind the microphone in the audience, and we'll take as many questions as we can in this period of time.
Thank you for the great talk. I'm a mathematician, and the
sorry to hear that. I was trained as one, so it's okay.
Okay, good. The situation you described at the end about go to somebody in your field and say, I can't read your paper, is not going to happen to me, because mathematics has the culture that our papers are available. When I want to find a paper, if our library doesn't have it electronically, I'll go to the author's website. Very good chances there. If it's not there, I'll go to the thing called the archive, yeah, Listed at Cornell. Almost certainly it will be there. So the life sciences don't have this culture, yeah, of posting their papers, and I think they need to adopt it, because most copyright agreements that I've seen give the author the right to do that.
Right. So that's a little more complicated. But I'll say that actually, you know, Pat can speak to this as well. You know, we looked at archive. You know, archive existed back when the internet, as we know it today, came online. And I think our original idea was just to clone archive for biomedicine. I think Pat even bought a server to do this on. And it seems so obviously the physicists and mathematicians have been doing the right thing forever, right? That it's a peculiar thing that biomedicine doesn't do it. There's nothing that stops us from doing it, right? We can easily put our papers online. We can easily make them available, whether it's through archive or any other repository. We choose not to do it. It's an active choice that people make to sign away their rights to their own papers and then force their libraries and their universities to buy them back. I wish I could put my finger on exactly what it is that's wrong with biomedical scientists and chemists and others, and that they haven't been just following what the physicists and mathematicians have done. It would have been so much simpler if all that this had taken was setting up a version of archive for biology. It was proposed, some version of basically that was proposed by Harold Varmus back in 1999, and it was met with, you know, fairly, I wouldn't say universal criticism. A lot of scientists thought it was a good idea. But people in the scientific establishment, the people who actually make the decisions about how journals are going to function and how money's going to be allocated, eviscerated this idea as being, you know, okay for those weird freaks in physics and math, but not okay for biomedicine. And we're suffering the consequences of that totally unacceptable and terrible decision. If in publishing at least we acted like physicists and mathematicians, I'd be at home doing work rather than talking to you guys.
Hi. So at the beginning of your talk, you claimed that making scientific journals freely available to the public would be likely to result in, or might result in, articles that the public could understand.
Yes.
And so I was wondering if you have evidence for that.
I guess the best evidence to say is that there actually are a lot of papers that are accessible to the public. So at PLOS, you know, articles are freely available. Some large fraction of the population takes an interest in these papers, right? You know, usually they're when they have, you know, nice subjects like bat fellatio and things like that. But there is a latent interest the population has in scientific articles. And there's, you know, we can't find out if everybody's reading them, but I've gotten questions from people, you know, non-scientists who've read papers I've written in my lab, and I don't work on anything nearly as interesting as that. So it's, I think that there are some papers that are already written in a way that's fairly accessible. And I should point out, being accessible to the public is not really any different than being accessible to a wide scientific audience, right? Someone who's a physicist is no more familiar with the technical language of immunology than a member of the public is. And I think the fact is we know from experience that some scientists, maybe all scientists, are capable of writing papers that are accessible to a wide audience, at least a wide audience of scientists. And it's really just the fact that they choose not to do it, or they don't have an incentive to do it in writing their regular scientific papers that prevents it. I'm sure there are scientists who can't do it. There are different levels of writing ability out there in the world. But I've seen lots and lots of stuff written by lots and lots of scientists that actually is fairly accessible to the public. And most scientists I know, you know, they end up sitting next to someone on an airplane who's, you know, not a scientist. They have a way of explaining what they do to a non-technical audience. We all are good at it, or, you know, we do it all the time. And the idea that we don't do it in the papers we actually publish is crazy. It's possible. I can't prove to you that that's what's going to happen, but I think that by making papers accessible and giving people at least some incentive to make those works more accessible to the public, I think that we get a literature that was much, much, much clearer, not just for the public, but also for scientists as well.
Hi, Rob Judson. I'm a postdoc at UCSF in stem cell biology. Agree with everything you said and loved it, but one question I have is, as inspirational as your story is and the people in your lab, as I look at UCSF and the people they consider to hire as faculty, and I look at my peers and see who's being considered at major institutes, I still feel I see a very strong correlation between publication in the cell sciences and natures than the open access.
But remember, you're a scientist, so one of the first things you've been probably taught is that correlation does not imply causation, right? And so there is undoubtedly a correlation between publication in high-impact journals and getting hired at these institutions. But I would argue that the reason that correlation exists is that the same criteria and the same standards are applied by the people who are screening papers for publication in those journals as the people who are deciding who to hire at their universities. Sure. And so I totally stipulate the correlation. It's undoubtedly there. But the idea that you have to do those things, that the people who have two science papers on their CV and that they did excellent work, right? That was what got them those science papers, or in most cases got them those science papers. That the idea that they couldn't have gotten the same job they got if they published that paper in PLOS Biology or even PLOS One, I think is mistaken. And certainly people have placed much, much, much greater premium on the title of the journal in which people published works in than on the work itself. And I just don't think it's true. I've sat in lots of faculty search meetings. People, for the good candidates, they read their letters, they read their papers. It's just not the case that you have to publish in these journals in order to get
a job. And I agree with you, but what I was going to ask is, can you point me towards a database? I mean, there must be studies on the people who are hired for faculty, and where they published before they're hired, right? Is there any place that we can actually see this data? And as trainees...
Yeah, so I had you can get that kind of information. It's a little bit tricky, right? Nobody keeps a database of new faculty hired and so forth. But I had a graduate student who did an analysis in which they took PubMed, took data from PubMed, and looked at everybody who in the previous 2 years had switched from being the first author on papers to being the last author on papers, which is in biomedicine, that's a sign that they went from being a postdoc to having a faculty position. And then they looked at where they published their papers. And in fact, the people who had published in open access journals did better than their colleagues. Now, you know, it's not a perfect study. There's all sorts of ascertainment issues in that. But it's at least some evidence that there are lots of people out there who are getting faculty positions and good faculty positions without publishing in these high-impact journals. It's certainly not just me. And I think we have let ourselves be convinced by people telling us what often amount to old wives' tales about the importance of publishing in these journals, so much so that we're willing to do things that everybody admits are bad for science. It would be great if people just stopped taking this as dogma and went out and actually looked around them. I guarantee that in your department at UCSF, there are people who were hired. but this is the kind of thing that won't get you a job. But there are people who were hired. There are people who were hired in your department without a Science, Nature, or Cell paper and who got tenure without it. I guarantee there are people like that in your department. So why do people continue to insist that this is a requirement for getting a job? I don't know.
Okay. Hello. I'm a computer scientist, actually, at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, pretty close to you. The issue, I'm totally 100% at the same page with you for the first part of your talk about open access. But I think I lost you when you suggested that the future of publishing is plus one. Because I see that specialized journals, I actually go to tables of contents. And I hate wasting my time trying to figure out. There's too many. In computer science, we're big enough that actually it's totally impossible to understand somebody in distributed systems if I'm not working in distributed systems.
So I agree. Maybe I didn't make this perfectly clear. That I agree that PLOS One, if all we did was dump all of our papers into one giant journal and you know let everybody have to find things, it would be a difficult system. You could still find them by searching, but you'd have to know what to search for and so forth. So PLOS One as it exists today is only half of the solution. The other half of the solution is to have scientists who review and read papers write down somewhere, in some structured way, who they think is going to be interested in this paper. So that what you would get today as the table of contents of the journal of whatever subsystem you're working in is replaced by a feed of reviewers saying, these are papers that are important to anybody in this field. Right? It accomplishes the same thing without having to go through, and it's done, you know, essentially by the same people, right? The decision is rendered by the same people making that judgment. We're just recording that judgment in a different way, in a way that's simpler, you know, cheaper, better for everybody. So I agree completely that you want to take advantage of the entire scientific community, not just three peer reviewers at the time a paper is published, but everybody who ever reads that paper to try to give you the kind of thing we've all been talking about, right? A virtual journal in which you get a feed constantly of papers that are published anywhere in the world that are relevant to you, rather than just the 17 papers or whatever that happen to be chosen by editors of a specific journal on any given day. So I agree with you with the problem, but I think that there's a much better way of doing it than having journals today.
Thank you.
So very related to that, I've been working with Rob at UCSF to develop a system for to kind of change the workflow of how people discover papers and then annotate them. Yeah. And we've been generating levels of annotation that are significantly higher than anything we've measured elsewhere on the internet. And so first of all, hi. It's nice to meet you. second of all, if the annotation problem begins to get solved, if we're able to generate significant amounts of annotation on published research, what role do you think that will play in moving the open access movement forward?
Yeah, so I think that right, I would say it's not the only thing, but it's the major thing that's keeping people from publishing entirely in open access journals and entirely in journals like PLOS One is the fact that we still rely on this antiquated journal hierarchy as the primary way in which we learn things about the paper, right? When people review a paper or people assess a paper, they reduce their judgment down to a single you know, title in a paper. That's obviously an inefficient way of doing it, but it's the one that we have, and it's the one that people are used to. So I think that as soon as we have systems that are obviously better than the ones that we have today, the incentive for people to continue publishing in these journals will start to evaporate. When people are finding out about papers because your tool or someone else's is telling them about them, and when they're learning about papers, not because they were published in Nature, but because they were marked up in a certain way, the value of that Nature citation is going to be diminished and ultimately be reduced to nothing. And since that is the major thing that's propping up the system that exists today, the more of these kind of tools we can develop, and the faster we can get them out to the community and start applying them to the literature in a useful way, the better. I think that is the last piece, right? The last thing we need. We have the journals, we have the systems, we have the business model, we have big publishers participating in open access. The last thing that's standing between actually, you know, making it 100% and everybody doing things this way is solving this problem of prestige and annotation of the literature and getting away from journal titles and towards something that is applied in a more uniform and more 21st century rather than 17th century way.
So the container of the journal, the published journal, seems to be sort of the atomic device you're moving around and trying to manipulate, yet it's still a multi-century old invention due to the printing press page-oriented function. I thought maybe you might have ideas on how to explode this and get to the deeper level subatomic components.
Right. I mean, I think everybody in science recognizes that there's something artificial and also antiquated about just the simple idea of writing a paper. It's you know, there's some value in it. There's some value in sitting back and saying, well, I did all this work. Here's what I think about it. A lot of interesting thought happens when you're removed from the process of doing research in the lab and doing things on a day-to-day basis and have to step back and put it into context and try to explain it for an audience. But it's also obviously true that this is capturing only a small part of what the process of communicating and thinking about your work really should be. And I think, you know, the answer is, I don't want to completely explode the idea that you're going to write papers, because I do find that process useful to have stuff put down in a somewhat digested form. But the real problem isn't that we're writing papers, it's that we're not capturing any of the other kind of stuff that goes on in the research environment. You know, we don't, you know, there are some scientists who do it, but not a lot, who are sort of blogging about their research on a daily basis. People have put their lab notebooks online. All of this stuff is more or less completely invisible to other scientists. And even when you publish stuff, most of the activity that went into a paper, most of the thought, most of the day-to-day actions of science are lost to the world. And it would be fantastic and incredibly useful to everybody involved in science and everybody not involved in science if we had better ways of capturing and communicating that stuff to the world. I don't know exactly what that's going to be. I think that you know, one of the problems is you're punished in many ways in this current age for doing things that way, right? For putting all your stuff online. Nobody, you know, it still happens. If you write a blog about your science, people don't consider that when you're coming up for tenure. They should, but they don't. So the same kind of, you know, old school kind of way of thinking about what's important in science, it kind of keeps that stuff down to the real kind of radical fringe of the world who are eager to do this kind of thing, you know, just simply, you know, despite the fact that it might not advance their career. So I think, you know, I like to think that if we can crack the nut of the scientific paper and make the way in which we assess and use scientific publications and get away from journal titles there, that it'll enable and start giving value to, you know, when you post your data online as you're generating it or other kinds of things, we can, the boundaries between, you know, data and science on a day-to-day basis in a scientific publication are way too high today. There shouldn't be this kind of crisp line. And I think, again, if we can solve the problem with scientific papers, it's going to make spreading that out into other forms of, you know, more high bandwidth communication between scientists and other scientists a lot more, you know, recognizable and, you know, recognized by people as a value and something that they can build their careers on. It's not something we have good methods for doing yet, but I really do think, I agree, it's an important part of the future of scientific communication that we are not doing at all a good job of dealing with today.
Hi. As an outside person looking in, I couldn't help wonder, wouldn't the application of this model, like, really, like, ripple outwards into other forms and I suppose, other aspects of media and communication as well?
Yeah, I mean, there are some, you know, I often get asked the question of, like, aren't you just proposing, like, Napster for science, right? Like that, and that somehow that there's a, no, I mean that, you know, I think the answer is partly yes and partly no. And the reason it's partly no is that in science publishing is different than, say, the music world or the newspaper business or a lot of other things where the people who are actually creating content are depending upon selling their content as a way of making their living, right? So the, you know, if you're publishing a newspaper, someone has to pay those reporters, right? And there, so you know, I want to get, you know, the New York Times for free, but the people who work at the New York Times want me to pay for it, right? So you have this tension between the interests of the producers of information and the consumers of information. That tension is gone in science, right? To a large extent, the producers and consumers of the information are the same people. And there is a third party, the universities, funding agencies, and so forth, who's both paying the salaries of the people who are doing the research and paying for the process of publishing. So this tension that exists in music and publishing, in book publishing, in newspaper publishing, in all sorts of other creative endeavors is not present in science. And this is why one of the reasons I think that for those people who do care about having better access to other types of information, music, videos, movies, and other things, you know, if we can't figure out how to make the scientific literature freely available, where these things are, this tension is not present, we're going to fail completely to make even modest progress in making other types of information where this tension does exist freely available. So, I'd love it if what we do here can, you know, inspire models for the production of music that's freely available and funded by some third party or whatever. I just think that there are some distinct properties of scholarly publishing that don't map so clearly onto these other endeavors.
Fair enough.
Unfortunately, we're down to our last question.
Okay.
I'm another outsider. Consumer of scientific journalism and someone who has dabbled in trying to find things out. And one of the conundrums that I face, and I think it's very much, is quality. And I don't even know if I should rely on a reporter writing a massive article in the New York Times Magazine about some studies to know whether those studies are even very good. There's a concern for me because scientific method and evidence-based, you have, you know, problems with the FDA, even all these things, when they affect the human body, people experimenting on themselves. Maybe these are the fears. On another side, you must know that the U.S. News and World Report ranks institutions based on citations.
Sure.
This might cut both ways with public. Maybe it depends where the citations are. The world is competitive, and so are scientists, and so are universities. And they are competing for prestige in order to get supposedly the best minds in the world. I'm throwing out two things, but quality as a consumer of medical journalism, scientific journalism, I don't know when a study is that good.
So
what can a journalist
I agree.
Do
Look,
to assure
I,
me? And then
let's just start out by saying the first thing, which is that it's clear, like, for anybody who's concerned about actually measuring what works are good, you know, which scientists are good and who's done good work, or anybody who cares about the validity of scientific publishing, the current system sucks, right? So let's start with the principle that what we have today is not doing what you want to accomplish, right? The citations in journals, things like that, are a very bad measure of the quality of the people doing the work, and they're a very bad measure of the validity of the work. I think you've probably seen all these studies that have come out in the recent years where, you know, 85% of the published findings in medicine have turned out to be wrong. It's the system we have today is doing a really terrible job of figuring out which works of science are good and which scientists deserve the most acclaim for doing them. So first of all, let's start out by saying that there's no, if you're worried about these things, what you should want to do is to abandon the current system, not to reinforce it. So no, but I'm serious. Like, I think that I'm concerned about these things. Nobody, like, we all want a system in which the actual quality of works is recognized, where if something is turns out to be wrong or something turns out to be right, there's a very easy way for people who are who are, you know, credible in the field and people who are respected to make these judgments, or just the, you know, the community as a whole, are able to render those decisions. I think today we have a system that doesn't do that, right? You know, a science paper that's ridiculed by scientists and the press still is a science paper for eternity. And it will look like a science paper 20 years from now when you do a search. Nobody will know that it's laughed at. And that's because we put too much value on this notion of a narrow slice of assessment that happens during the initial peer review. So I believe quite strongly that if we have a much more open system in which scientists, anytime they read a paper, or members of the public, or anybody can comment on, assess the quality of individual works, and individual papers build up an annotation that comes from other scientists, that comes from all over the community, it comes from automated methods and non-automated methods and other things, so that when you are asking about whether a particular work is valuable, you have more to go on than it was published in, you know, the Journal of Clinical Psychology in 2003. You have a whole body of assessment that happens afterwards. That's something we do not do well in science today, and we don't do it well because the only thing that matters to scientists is the citation. You know, a million people can say that something was a great, brilliant idea. If it was published in an insignificant journal, it will look that way on your CV, and vice versa. So I think everybody wants to have a system in which we can look at a paper and quickly find out, you know, what people in the community think about it, where there might be disagreement among people, who thinks it's good and why, who thinks it's bad and why. And the only way to do that is to break the hegemony of the established scientific publishers and to come up with a new system.
Our thanks to Professor Eisen for his insightful comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.